God,
God,
we invite you here tonight to guide us and direct us. Please set aside that within each of us that would block us from the truth. Please set aside what I think I know about this weekend, about these facilitators, about spirituality, about spiritual awakening, about the meaning of struggle, about the gifts I receive from you. So I may have an open mind, an open heart, and a new experience with all these things. Amen.
All right, so this reading is called How to Fail in Everything. Knock everything systematically. No matter what you hear of, deprecate it and predict the worst. Mind everybody else's business. This will ensure you're neglecting your own. Never perform today what you can possibly postpone until tomorrow. Leave the important things to someone else instead of seeing to them personally. Have no organized arrangements. Trust to luck for everything. Be a sanctimonious humbug. And when you bungle things, say it's the Lord's will, or that the trouble is that you are too good for your surroundings. Sit down and wait for something to turn up. Finally, conduct your life in all aspects as if there were no God. Deliver me from all my transgressions. Make me not the reproach of the foolish. Psalms 39:8.
So earlier I was sharing that experience I had in the courtroom with my mother. And the way I describe it, looking back on it, it's almost as if I was split wide open in that moment. Something in me was reduced. I call it the ego. It wasn't. I don't believe the ego can be destroyed. I don't think the ego can not be included in all our experience. There's a trace of the ego in everything. So maybe it was involved in the surrender. You know, maybe the ego knew that if I kept going the way I was going, the physical body would die, and then it would die. And so, you know, maybe it was used in that way. I just don't know. But I do know that it was thinned out, because when every other time I'd been to treatment, I'd been to a sober living, I had a plan. It wasn't all my fault. I knew where to assign the blame. I knew what I was going to do, who I was going to manipulate. I always had something I could maneuver. And this time was very different. It's almost as if the ego was taken out of the driver's seat, not even put in the passenger seat. It was put in the back seat. And that was a temporary experience, but it lasted long enough for me to follow the directions that were given to me by another man. And they let me out of that jail after 5 weeks, and they delivered me to a treatment center. I got there in the early part of the week it was like a Monday or Tuesday, and I kept saying I had to go down to this Friday night meeting so I could find this guy, Dante. Nobody at the treatment center I was in wanted to go to this Friday night meeting because it was so far. It was like a 40-minute drive. And they just wanted to go look at girls at the meeting down the street. But somehow over the course of that week, I guess they got tired of me asking them if they were taking us to that meeting. They caved and they took us all to that meeting. And I didn't have any phone numbers at this point. We got there late. I jumped out of the van and I beelined it up to the church. It was raining on this Friday night, and there was one man outside on his cell phone. It was a guy who had tried to sponsor me like 2 years prior to this, and he was also sponsored by this guy, Dante. And I remember him taking me to Dante's big book study. I'd gone to like a party at his house, so he was my in. And I walked up to him and I said, please help me. I don't want to die living the way I'm living. And which isn't a very true statement for me today because I wasn't doing much living. You know, surviving maybe. Not much of a human being at that point. And so he started working with me. That man came to the treatment center and he directed me to go to Dante's house every Monday night. So I was working the steps with Dante on Monday night in his workshop. And then this man was coming over once a week to read the big book with me. And every week we would, like, it was like clockwork. They had like this recipe they were following. Like the first week he sat down with me, he looked at the blank page, the title page, the table of contents, the preface, the forewords. And he's like, okay, next week we'll do the doctor's opinion. Then we'll do there's a solution. Or Bill's story, there's a solution, more about alcoholism. We did the chapter to the agnostics, but then there was a turning point for me. I will never forget this. Like, I remember him coming over. We're going to do the third step. And he said, look, I'm going to make this very simple for you. The third step is just you making a decision to work the rest of the steps. That's all we need to worry about right now. And it was so easy for me to be able to say, okay, that makes a lot of sense. I can do that. But that wasn't the turning point. The turning point is when me and this man walked into the storage closet in the basement of this dingy treatment center, and we got our hands or knees on the floor in the storage closet, and we held hands, and we read the third step prayer out of the book. And in the world I come from, you don't get down on your knees and hold hands with another man. And that was something new, and there was no resistance to it in me. It was one of those things, looking back on it, where I know that I was willing to go to any lengths. This man needed me to get on my knees and hold his hands and read this prayer. Oh yeah, I'm down. And I started going through the steps. I wrote this inventory. I was in a treatment center. I told you guys at the beginning, I was born in Syria. And so this treatment center, it had 17 men in it. And as of today, as far as I know, 7 of them are dead. I'm the only one that's clean and sober. That's a 1 out of 17 stat. Do the math. That's not good. That's like 7%. What did we say? How many people in here? It's 49? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's like 2 of y'all. 3 of y'all. 3.5. And so I've got this court case going on. And they said they tried to give me 3 years in prison. I could get out to a work camp after 18 months. My lawyer said, well, let's just continue the case. Let's see if they get a new district attorney on the case. See if it gets put on another judge's docket. In the meantime, the longer you stay sober, the better it looks for us in court. And I continued working the steps. And so in that treatment center, every day you had rec activity. I don't know if you guys have rec here, but every day at like 1 or 2 p.m. we had to go do a rec activity. Go play softball, basketball, whatever it is. And I was asking staff to skip out on the rec activity. I wanted to hang out and write my fourth step. It was more important. Don't know why it was more important other than it was the grace and mercy of God to make it more important in my life. And the guys would come back after rec and they'd make fun of me for writing inventory. They called me names like 12-step Nazi, big book Nazi. How do you use that word? How do you have it in your heart to use that word to describe someone who's enthusiastic about something they're trying to do to save their lives? And so we had a softball team. And so everybody got to put their names on the back of their... Somebody was in charge of it. So I get my shirt for the softball team. And since I'm from the Middle East, what they decided to put on the back of my shirt was 12-step terrorist. It was rough that day when I got that shirt because, on the outside I had to laugh about it. But on the inside it was crushing, But that's the crazy thing about the, like, it's almost as if it's not like cool to work the 12 steps or something. That's the kind of treatment center I was in. We're way past that, guys. This is your life that's on the line. Yeah. Your life is on the line. If anybody else hasn't told you this, let me be the first to tell you that if you're sitting in this seat, that you are truly fucked. Yeah, I know. I was going to say doomed, but I wanted to say that now, so that's out. Because you know what? The entire steps 2 through 12 are about un-effing yourself. But I sit here almost 18 years into this and still know that left to my own devices, I'm screwed. I got to have a lot of God going on in my life or there's going to be a lot of crack smoking in my life. And so I started to document my recovery. Every drug screen I took and passed, I asked them for a copy. I ended up getting a job at that treatment center. The clinical director, Gail, I was like a 2 or 3 months sober. I caught fire with the big book. And the clinical director of my treatment center, she goes to some of the meetings that I was going to, and she sees like how enthusiastic I am about giving guys rides to meetings and talking to them about going to Dante's house on Monday night. And she hears the stuff I'm talking about in group at the treatment center. I haven't started sharing because I don't think I shared in a meeting until I was probably somewhere between 3 and 4 months. I'm always fascinated by the guys that relapse and they come back to their very first meeting and they just want to share, right? They just want to share.
They're on their float. They want to tell everybody while they're half in the water, like, man, I got the answer. I was the captain of a big vessel not that long ago.
I mean, some of the most spiritual words I heard in the beginning were, get in the car and shut up and listen. Shut up and listen and get in the car. And that's what we did. That's how we rolled. And I got this job at the treatment center, and then this woman, Gail, the clinical director, decided to ask me to lead a big book study. Here I am, 2-3 months sober. She's like, you lead the big book study at the treatment center. And as it turned out, I led that big book study for the first 3 years, well after I left that treatment center. I did it for 3 years. And little did she know, that was one of those foundation stones that she was helping me set. And then I got another job as a valet, parking cars at a really nice restaurant in Atlanta. And I got back into school. I'd been kicked out of school a few years before, been taking a bunch of money from my parents. They never knew I'd been kicked out of school. So there's all that. And I got my own little studio apartment right down the street from the treatment center. I documented all this. I got people to write character letters, and my case kept getting continued. And about a year into it, I'm standing in my little studio apartment. I think I'd just gotten back from the gym. And I get a phone call. My attorney had a meeting with the assistant district attorney that morning. And he says, Tarek, I don't understand what happened. Somebody upstairs truly loves you. They've dropped all the charges. Two Schedule 1 felonies. One was intent to distribute, the other was trafficking. Vanished. No probation. No paper. Totally did not understand what had happened. So when we talk about this second step and we talk about coming to believe, this is part of my coming to believe. Because it didn't make any sense to me what had happened. You know, when I got to step 8 and I had to make a list of all the drug dealers, the guys that took me through this process, I had to go make amends to all the drug dealers I owed money to, especially the ones that I broke bread with and I hung out with and we were in each other's homes. That was not chalk it up to the game, you know. The guys me and Jeff ripped off on the corner, though, that was donate money to the homeless shelter downtown Atlanta, not go back out on the corner and try to find those guys, right? But you know, what do I tell those guys? Hey man, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. A lot of people thought I worked for the police. There was a rumor going around that I was a narc, but what do you do? I mean, you can't say anything. A lot of the people on my 8-step list refused to see me for a while, but as a couple years would go on, then I got in front of a lot of them, paid back a lot of money. We'll talk about that hopefully later in the weekend. But I'm standing there in that studio apartment, and my lawyer is delivering this news to me, And all I can think about is this one line in the preface. I don't want to butcher it. I always just do it, but I'm going to actually read it. To show others precisely how we recovered is the main purpose of this book. For them, we hope these pages are proof so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. They're talking about if you read our stories and our relationship with drugs and alcohol, I'm using drugs generally here, and we hope after you listen to our stories, you don't need to authenticate for yourself anymore. But that's not what is happening to me. This idea of miracle and God and this universe doing for me what I can't do for myself, like spirituality, that's what needed no further authentication. All right? If you're sitting in this room tonight and you don't believe in miracles and you don't believe in spirituality, you don't believe in spiritual experiences, and you don't believe your spirit can wake up, you're screwed. You're screwed. But here's the really amazing thing. All you got to do is change your mind. All you got to do is decide to believe. That's how simple this is. Or you can sit and debate and fight and be self-righteous and be intolerant, just like you're accusing all the other religious and spiritual people of their intolerance. We become the very thing we are saying we don't want. And so we have a solution here. This is going to take more than 7 minutes. We have a solution here, and I want to tell a story because it's the best story I've ever heard. I did not originate this story, but God helped me the first time I heard it. I committed it to memory. And I heard the man tell the story, and I fell in love with it. But let's just say for a second, there's a guy named Elric. Okay, this guy named Elric. And Elric grows up, and most of his life, he's uncomfortable in his skin, right? He finds the world an unfriendly place most of the time. He finds himself uneasy, easily annoyed with life, people, situations, and just has this overpowering sense of dissatisfaction for life. But Elric, he's my boy, man. I love him. I want to see him do well. And I tell him, man, I think you should talk to my boy, Jeff. Jeff has had an experience. And I think it's really, really going to serve you well if you sit down and spend some time with him. You know, because growing up, man, it was hard for Elric to talk to girls at parties. He felt uncomfortable dancing. Just thought life was a burden, and he was just getting by, right? So, you know, so I'm going to hook him up with my boy, Jeff. So they sit down together, and Jeff looks at Elric. They're sitting across the table from each other. And, you know, he thinks he's got a solution here. He's like, well, Elric, tell me a little bit about yourself. And Elric tells him what I just told you. And Jeff turns to Elric and says, Elric, have you ever thought of taking a drink? And Elric says, well, you know, my mom was, you know, she was part of, you know, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. We've had a lot of problems in our family with drinking and alcoholism. My mom said if I took a drink, I'd never amount to anything in life. Alcoholism runs in our family. You know, she said I'd even lose my hair and go blind if I took a drink. And so I just have never taken a drink. And Jeff says to Elric, you know, for about 90% of the people on this planet, taking a drink, it's just another event that takes place in their lives. It's like going to the donut shop and getting a glazed donut and having a cup of coffee. But for 10% of the people on this planet, drinking is a remarkable experience. For 10% of the people on this planet, taking a drink creates a vast change in feeling and outlook. Taking a drink creates a profound alteration in how you take life. It can even create a psychic change. Some people even call that a spiritual awakening. And Jeff leans back in his seat, and he looks under the table, and he pulls out this bottle of Kentucky bourbon. This bottle right here will answer all your problems, every single one of them. You will have a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from your insecurity. In this bottle, if you drink what's in this bottle, you'll be amazed before you're halfway through. You'll know a new life. It'll take on new meaning. You won't regret the past, nor will shut the door on it. You'll intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle you. This bottle can do for you what you cannot do for yourself. But lightweights do not make it. Half measures will avail you nothing. You must abandon yourself utterly to this bottle and what's in it. And then you will have an awakening. You will have an awakening. It's a great description. Let me read something to you about this awakening. Can I see your reading glasses, please? Yeah. Elric, if you abandon yourself to this bottle, this is possible. You will have a spiritual awakening. The most important meaning of it is that you will become able to do, to feel, and believe what you could not do before on your unaided strength and resources alone. You will be granted a gift which amounts to a new state of consciousness and being. You will be set on the path which tells you that you're really going somewhere. That life is not a dead end, not something to be endured or mastered. In a very real sense, you will be transformed by the contents of this bottle. Because you will lay hold of a source of strength which in one way or another you have denied yourself. You will find yourself in possession of a degree of tolerance, unselfishness. Buy everyone a drink. Peace of mind and love which you thought yourself quite incapable. What you will have received is a free gift. But at least in some small part, you have to make yourself ready to receive it. Are you ready to take this drink? And Elric struggles. He says, you know what? That's not the ideas. I have a lot of old ideas, and I got a lot of old thinking, and I'm just not willing to let go of it. That's not the way I was brought up. This stuff that you're talking about just is not going to work. These are extravagant promises. You're right. I thought that too, said Jeff. Well, if you change your mind, here's my phone number. When you get desperate enough and you're ready to take this trip with me with this bottle, give me a call. I'll be more than glad to help. So Elric left, and he went out, and he got in the car with me, and we started talking about it. I said, how did it go with Jeff? Elric said, man, that guy's weird, man. He was talking about all kinds of things like fourth dimension and a spiritual awakening. I just don't believe it. I just don't believe it. I don't think that's going to work. And Elric just went on with his life. For the next 40 years, he just survived. He grunted the day-to-day. He grinded it out, because that's the new cool thing to say. And then he reached about age 70, and it was time for him to die. And he was sitting on his deathbed, and his wife was next to him. And he kept drifting in and out of consciousness. And this one time, he came back into consciousness, and his wife said, where'd you go? And Elric said, you know, I drifted back to like 30 or 40 years ago when I went to sit with that guy, Jeff. I wonder what my life would have been like if I'd taken that drink. And he died. And you might say to yourself, what is the point of that story? Isn't that what we do here? We tell people the good news. We tell them what's possible. We tell them the need for a psychic change through a spiritual program of action. We tell them to watch other people, to abandon themselves to this program, this way of life. That these promises in the ninth step, after we're halfway through these ninth step amends, these things begin to happen. Fear of people and economic insecurity will just leave us. You know, self-seeking will slip away. You guys go find yourself a psychologist and psychiatrist, right? Hey, if I do like, you know, once a week sessions with you and I talk about myself, will self-seeking just slip away after like the fourth session? They don't have any experience with those type of descriptions, slipping away. I mean, just think about it. But what are we sold all the time? All these other things. Other modalities that are marginal at best, everybody. Marginal at best with results. But what we have here is access, an accessible power. That's the solution here. But here's what's going to come up tomorrow for us. Is if we know the solution, do we know it in such a way that it makes a difference in our lives? Do we know it in such a way that, why do we continue? We all know the solution. Why do we continue to have problems? Why are we $30,000 in debt? Why are we committing infidelity? Why are we chasing things that we know aren't in our highest good? Why are we racking up debt? Why are we shopping all the time? Buying the next thing that has shine on it, if we know what the solution is. So that's the next question. But just like Elric in that story, it's the same thing. The only thing is it was the wrong higher power. It was the wrong higher power. I turn it over to you.
Anybody in here like cheesecake? Yeah. I like cheesecake a lot. Like a lot. Anybody ever go to New York and have Junior's cheesecake?
Yeah.
Okay. So, like, there's a lot of things that we hear about that, like, people say, "Oh, you gotta go do this. You gotta go here. You gotta try this or whatever." And so, a couple Christmases ago, my family and I went to New York, and there was a whole list of the things that we had to do, and one of them was, you know, you have to eat New York pizza. It was all right. And you got to go to Junior's Cheesecake and have Junior's Cheesecake. And, like, I was cool with that because I like cheesecake, but, like, I kind of figured it was going to be like everything else. And so we go to Junior's Cheesecake just off Times Square, and I get a red velvet cheesecake. And I take a bite of this, and I'm like, holy crap. Like, this is the best cheesecake ever, right? So much so that I go back and I have another piece of cheesecake and so on and so forth. And then I kept trying to get everybody else to want to go back to get another cheesecake. And so we get back from this trip, and somehow through whatever happens, I end up with a copy of Junior's Cheesecake recipe. Okay, now Junior's Cheesecake, one of the things that they're known for is that their crust is like a sponge cake crust. I prefer a graham cracker crust, but so I modify the recipe a little bit. And now the recipe is like super specific. It's kind of weird. Like, so a regular block of cream cheese is 8 ounces. Okay, and Junior's Cheesecake recipe calls for 15 ounces. You gotta chop off an ounce off the second block, and that's what you make it with. Okay, I've had some cheesecakes where you put powdered sugar in. This one calls for a very specific amount of sugar, and then you have to mix it for a certain amount of time. You have to chill it. The crust. I follow a recipe for a graham cracker crust. Now, the graham cracker crust, you crush up the right amount of graham crackers, you put it in the crust. Now, if you put too much butter in the crust, what happens is it crumbles, okay? And if you don't put enough butter in the crust, it sticks. So you got to follow the recipe and make sure that you got the exact right amount of butter so that the graham cracker holds together but doesn't stick. And then you have to cook it at a very specific temperature for a certain amount of time. And then you have to put it in the fridge so that it chills, so that it settles and does all these things, right? So I cooked this cheesecake, and like, it's not like Junior's cheesecake, but it's good cheesecake, right? It's like some of the best cheesecake I've ever had. And so I cook it one time, and Gustavo comes over, and Gustavo is going to try, I give him a piece of the cheesecake, and he's like, oh my God, this is like the greatest cheesecake ever. You got to give me the recipe. And I'm like, sure. You know, I tell him all the things and the specifics, and I write it down and I give it to him. He's like, good, because my mom loves cheesecake. So you wouldn't think it, but she does. And so he goes home to cook his mom this cheesecake, and he gets there and he goes in the fridge, and well, he first goes in the pantry and he doesn't find any graham crackers. So, but they got some saltines, right? So he crushes up these saltines, puts the butter in it, and makes a saltine crust for it. It's not graham cracker, but it's saltine, right? And then he goes in the fridge to start making the cheesecake, and he doesn't have blocks of cream cheese, but he's got this whipped jalapeno cream cheese that he puts on his bagel, and he's like, well, I'll just use that, right? And he doesn't have any sugar, so he uses some brown sugar, and then he cooks this thing, but he's kind of anxious to really have his mom try it, so he doesn't cook it long enough, and he doesn't chill it and everything else. But he's so excited to give his mom this cheesecake, and he goes and he gives it to his mom, and she eats it, and she spits it at him, and he calls me, and he's like, dude, what the hell? And I'm like, what are you talking about? And he goes, I made the cheesecake and my mom thought it was terrible. And I said, well, did you use the cracker crust? And he goes, yeah. I was like, and you use the cream cheese? Yeah. And you put the sugar in it? He's like, yeah. And I'm like, and you baked it, and then you didn't, and then you chilled it. And he goes, well, I didn't really have time to chill it, but I did all the other stuff. And I'm sitting there thinking, like, man, it doesn't make sense that just because you didn't chill that cheesecake, it doesn't make sense that it would be that bad. So I start asking him more questions about, like, what he did. And eventually it comes out that he's made this saltine jalapeno cream cheese brown sugar cheesecake that he fed his mom. And I'm like, dude, that is not the recipe. No wonder that she didn't like it. Get this. We got a recipe here, too. And our recipe is contained in this book. When you follow the recipe in this book specifically, you only 100% of the time, only 100% of the time, get the cheesecake that I'm talking about. But here's what happens. Is there's a bunch of you that you do some altered version of this, where you maybe don't make all your amends, you don't pray, you don't meditate, you don't sponsor anybody. Maybe you did a thorough fourth and a fifth step. And then when you relapse, you go and you share with everybody that the steps don't work. But you didn't follow the recipe. But if you follow the recipe, you get this creamy, wonderful cheesecake. Just delicious. So what happens is we get to these places where the psychic change starts to happen, right? The psychic change just means change of mind. That's it. And the recipe in this book helps move you through that process to get you to the change of mind. But what happens in the beginning, we take the suggestions, we're willing to do the things, but then things start happening. experiences start coming into our life. She's talking to me again. I'm earning some money. I got a better job. No longer have that just sober job where I was washing dishes or whatever it was. And I start to think that I'm doing this stuff. I start to think that I am the reason that all these things happened. And I start to lose touch with the fact that not that long ago, I was in this place where there was nothing I could do to stay sober at all. And so I start to slip. And so I don't know if my buddy who's out there smoking pot right now, he's really challenged a lot of the belief systems that I carry around because he was doing the stuff, it appeared. And he was praying and he was meditating and he was doing the 10-step calls and he was making the amends. And it really appeared like he was doing the whole thing. And then all of a sudden this thing happens where he gets in a fight with the crazy girlfriend, wife, and she rats about on his game because she's trying to isolate him and make this whole terrible thing happen. And it comes out that like we never really learned how long he's actually been doing the goofy shit, right? Maybe it was 6 months, maybe it was 2 years. We don't know what it was. But then you start kind of checking around the network and you start to realize, well, we haven't seen him in months. We haven't heard from him. He's been over there doing that thing, whatever that thing is. And so, you know, we were reading Jim's story the other night. I love the first paragraph of Jim's story, right? Because it's just steeped with delusion and steeped with like misinformation and like resentment and all these things where like when you really break that paragraph down, this dude's working for an automobile agency that he used to own. No, not feeling any certain way about that, are you? Had some work, came to work on Tuesday, right? Like, I don't know about you, anywhere I work, they want me to come in on Monday, but had some words with the boss, nothing serious. Like, Jim, where were you yesterday? I used to own this place, motherfucker! So then I decided to drive to the country for a customer about a car. But let me translate that. I got really angry at my boss after telling him off, and I stormed out of his office and said, I'm going to show him and go sell a car to this very specific person. On the way to the customer, I decided I was hungry, and I decided to stop and have a sandwich and some milk. Because I didn't want to be too hungry, angry, lonely, tired. I made sure I got a second sandwich and another glass of milk. But like somewhere in there, he thinks he's going into this bar to find a customer for a car. Jim, wait a second. I thought you had a very specific customer you were going to sell a car to. And now you're just thinking maybe over here there might be somebody. And then the word suddenly shows up, right? Suddenly, the thought hits that if I poured an ounce of whiskey into my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach. Was it really suddenly? Was it really suddenly? Or was there a series of events that was building to the event that suddenly happened? So we have to do this stuff, and we have to continue to do this stuff. I got an awesome phone call last night from a sponsee that I haven't heard from since March 3rd. Now, I was taking two gentlemen through the steps. I had gotten them up to their third column of their resentment inventory. We meet on Mondays. At about 2:30 in the afternoon, get a text message from said sponsee that says, my truck broke down on 285. Not sure if I'm going to make it tonight. I will try to be there. Interesting. get to the meeting that night, and the other guy that I'm meeting with goes, oh, that's terrible about his truck, isn't it? And I said, is it? You see, Luke, I've taken between 100 and 200 people through the steps. And yes, his truck may have broken down on 285, but isn't it weird that his third column of his resentment inventory was due tonight and his truck broke down? I suspect that he's either drunk or I will never hear from him again. And I said, that's what I know from taking that many people through the steps. And I was wrong. That was March 3rd. I heard from him on June the 5th at approximately 4:30 p.m. And he said, man, I haven't drank, but I'm out here dying. And he said, I need help. What happened was when I started getting into column 3 of my resentment inventory, I started reliving a bunch of those things. I had this happen and this happen and this happen. And I just couldn't continue to look at it. And I'm sorry I didn't call. Now, what I'm thinking to myself is, holy cow, when the mother of my children kicked me out and I had 17 resentments against her and I couldn't write resentment inventory on her because they were the first 17 resentments, I couldn't write any inventory at all because she came first. And it was suggested to me by my sponsor that maybe I started with resentment number 18 and go from there. And then after I went from resentment number 18 and then came back around, I was able to write inventory on her. Now, if he would have had that conversation with me back in the day, I could have shared my personal experience with him about struggling to write inventory. But instead, his truck broke down. And so the really good news is you don't have to go and bake that cheesecake all by yourself. There are a shit ton of people around that have helped hundreds of people bake cheesecake. And the problem is, you're too damn smart to ask for help. You're up against your own stuff. What will they think? They're going to make me feel like I'm not good enough. They're going to make me feel alone. They're going to make me feel like a failure. They're going to make me feel disrespected. They're going to make me feel rejected, such that I might as well just die. What we have here is a recipe that works all the time. But you guys have no idea how to follow the recipe. And you've got to have somebody guide you through this process. And we're going to talk about that tomorrow. So that's it for tonight. We're going to be back in here tomorrow at 9. 9? Good? Yeah. And until then, whatever they say you're going to do, that's what you're going to do. Thanks. Yeah.